We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, we're joined by a familiar face to most of you, I'm sure. That would be former White House press secretary, Fox contributor, and author Ari Fleischer, whose new book, Suppression, Deception, Snobbery, and Bias, Why the Press Gets So Much Wrong and Just Doesn't Care, is out on July 12th. Ari, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Emily.
Now, I'm sure our listeners are all familiar with your journey, and this book touches on, I think one of my favorite parts of the book is you're talking about sort of what happened, how did it used to be. There's a lot of really good history that you go through. Could you just talk to us a little bit about how your experiences working as a White House press secretary in the aughts for a Republican administration, how your, I guess, perspective on the media maybe has changed since that time period?
Oh, my gosh, it's changed so much. Look, I started on Capitol Hill in the 1980s, well before the aughts. Then I went to the White House, in those aughts, 2001 to 2003, and it was a different world. Back then, the media was liberal and everybody knew it. I knew it. You just had this sense that press really cared much more about what the Democrats thought. But still, they tried to be objective. Their job was to be objective. They told you that, and they really did not put their opinions on the air and let it rip. All that is ancient. With the advent of social media, and then particularly when Donald Trump became president, the press decided its job was to save the republic from the decision the people made in 2016 to elect Trump. And that took the press in the absolute wrong direction to make me write this book. My conclusion is that the American mainstream media is doing a terrible job for our country because they've become activists instead of reporters. And I call them out on it because our country needs a good press, a fair press, a neutral press. And today's press is anything but that.
And it's been really interesting. I think just reading the book, you see this. You start with one of my favorite, tragically favorite examples, which is Don Lemon and Rick Wilson openly mocking Donald Trump on air, laughing, from their nice air conditioned studios. Y'all elitists are dumb, blah, blah, blah. That's the whole quote. And it's just grotesque. And I want to ask if you think a segment like that ever would.
It wasn't that they were mocking Donald Trump. It was they were mocking people who supported Donald Trump.
Right.
And that's why I led the book with it, because we conservatives, especially populists and outsiders, people from rural areas, people who own guns, people who go to church every week, we know the press looks down on us. They just have this disdain. And when I saw it on CNN that night, I said, now it's leaped. It's gone from beyond making fun of Trump to making fun of half the country. And we cannot be a strong country if the press thinks that's okay.
What is the most interesting bit? And again, working in the White House, you're awash in history. And as you said, you were on Capitol Hill before that and have been around Washington, D.C., where pretty much you're always awash in history here. But is there an interesting anecdote from the history of the last 100 years of this country, or even maybe further back on that, that you think is particularly illustrative of how things were or how things should be?
Oh, sure. I mean, you don't have to go back to the 1970s, and I included the polling in the book. The press was trusted. If we saw it reported on CBS, NBC, ABC, which are really the only news shows in town, we believed it because it was a much more objective era. The press made its money from advertising. Advertising didn't want to appeal to the fringes. They wanted to have a united country so they could sell the most stuff. And that has been broken to smithereens since then. Now the news is all about niches, different people telling each other what they want to hear or see. And the press, especially the mainstream media, which is overwhelmingly just ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, New York Times, Washington Post, Associated Press, you name it. They have largely become opinion people, advocates for activists for a cause. And that's what's led to the lack of trust in by the American people in journalism. But here's the biggest thing that jumped out at me. It's no longer about liberal bias. It's now cultural.
Mm-hmm.
One of the polls that I cite shows that the only group of Americans who say that the press understands them are college-educated Democrats. So what you have is a slice of America, college-educated Democratic reporters, writing for a slice of America, college-educated Democrat readers and viewers. if you're a Democrat and you don't have a high school degree, or you have only a high school degree, you say the press doesn't understand you. Independents with college degrees and without college degrees say the press doesn't understand you. Republicans of all stripes say the press doesn't understand you. The only group of Americans left that say the press understands me are college-educated Democrats. And this is why global warming is told so often in the press. This is why taking a knee at a football game is actually seen as a polite market protest and there's something wrong with America. It's a slice of America talking to a slice of America that's marked only by college-educated Democrats.
And there was this dramatic acceleration in at least the, I guess, our ability to see that on display every single day during the Trump era. But did you start to see shades of this emerging prior to that in your interactions with the press?
Well, when I was there, it really was about liberal bias and liberals against conservatives, liberals against Bush. What I did see was it didn't take much to create the White House press corps leaping out of its seat to come after me or come after Bush, come after conservatives. And when Obama was in office, you can never get them to leap out of their seats. I mean, they loved the guy, and it showed in their copy. And one of the things I found researching this book is there have been a series of studies of the first 100 days of presidencies and how easy or hard the press was on the presidents. And Biden, of all people, got the softest press, followed by Obama. And of course, Bush and Trump got the worst press. Clinton was right in the middle. The press has favorites. They have ideological outcomes that they prefer. One of my favorite chapters in the book gets into policy discussions and the words the press uses. You know, they change spending to investment. Democrats always call spending investment, and the press went right along with them. But boy, they hold the Republicans to account. If it's a tax cut, they always say it blows up the deficit. Time after time, abortion rights. You don't see gun rights. You see abortion rights. The words they use, the language they pick is the Democrats' language. And it's reflected in policy. It's reflected in culture. It's reflected in politics.
And one of your chapters in the book is titled Too Good to Check. And, you know, that's always happened sort of occasionally in media, but it also seems like that's one of the things that accelerated. And I'm curious for your take on that. Are you seeing more outright false stories as the media's echo chamber becomes more and more impenetrable? Is that, you know, perhaps a symptom of this calcification?
And that actually, Emily, is what inspired me to write the book. Mm. I was just sitting at home, content. I run a nice business. I'm focused mostly on sports. And I was just watching the coverage of Donald Trump. And the American people elected him. Yet as soon as they elected him, the press turned on him as if it was their opinion about who the president should be. And the number of wrong stories about collusion, about the Steele dossier, about the Russians offering bounties to kill Americans in Afghanistan, every one of those stories turned out to be wrong. And so I'm watching all these false stories make it onto the air. But one of my favorite was they accused Donald Trump of stealing blue mailboxes from street corners so that he could steal the 2020 election because mailboxes were removed. They're always removed. They're removed every day, every year to be refurbished. Yet the press somehow thought it was Donald Trump trying to steal the election. Another one of my favorite anecdotes was when Biden was declared the winner, church bells rang in Paris that night, and fireworks went off in London. ABC News, CNN, The Hill, they all reported that these were international celebrations of Joe Biden's victory and Donald Trump's defeat. They had nothing to do with the American election. It was the weekly call to mass in Paris, and it was the anniversary, it's called Bonfire Night, a very British holiday that's commemorated every year for 500 years, celebrating the failed assassination attempt on King James I in 1601. Yet the American press reported these were celebrations. So what I witnessed was how many wrong stories make it on the air, all united around one theme, and that theme is Donald Trump is terrible. Hmm. Because that's what reporters thought. That's what college-educated Democrats thought. So the press shoehorned all the news, even if they fabricated it, made it up, ran with it, relied on the worst, most unreliable, anonymous source, which CNN did all the time, to get Donald Trump. And that's not journalism. That's not fair. And I supported Donald Trump, but I often called out Donald Trump. I still do. I tweeted things about him when I thought he did things inappropriate or wrong. But I'm more fair than the American mainstream media because they were just marked by being anti-Trump all the time.
You get into the Russia collusion narrative, and one of the most interesting things about that, and having such an inside perspective for so long that you've had, I'm so fascinated by what your analysis was on this. But just from an outsider perspective, looking at where the sourcing was coming from on that story, I mean, it seemed very clearly to be coming from, let's say, Adam Schiff's office, and it seemed to very clearly be coming from the intel community. And the relationship the press has with the intel community is a very interesting and very close one. What did you think? And you know, it's not even just the Russia collusion hoax. It's also that constant stream of palace intrigue that was coming out of the Trump White House. And you know, if you're here in Washington, D.C., you kind of can guess who some of this stuff is coming from. But what was it like from your perspective watching the media trot out the perspectives? I mean, maybe they're even doing it right now with Cassidy Hutchinson, of people who sort of turn on Trump or are working for Trump and turning on Trump and basically passing them off uncritically as neutral coverage of the administration.
Yeah, my favorite was a guy named Anonymous.
Yes, yes. Miles Taylor.
Miles Taylor, if you remember, he was the deputy chief of staff at the Department of Homeland Security, and he wrote an op-ed, gave it to the New York Times under the name Anonymous. And the New York Times printed it, in which he bashed Donald Trump. And the press went nuts. The news page at the New York Times chased the editorial page at the New York Times, trying to figure out who wrote this piece. Was it Vice President Pence? Was it Secretary of State Pompeo? Who was it? And it was this nobody. A deputy chief of staff is almost never at the White House. He's not in the Oval Office. He's not in meetings with the president. They wouldn't be. They wouldn't have a window. They wouldn't have knowledge. If that piece the New York Times said, it was authored by Miles Taylor, the deputy chief of staff at Homeland Security, everybody would have yawned.
Yes.
Nobody would have taken the piece seriously. They said, who is this kid? But by calling him Anonymous, the New York Times created a phony picture of how senior he was. And they wrote he's a senior administration official, which is why the news page of the New York Times asked the vice president, did you write it? Asked the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, did you write it? I've never seen such a tail chasing the dog. And this is what the press did. If you were a mid-level or even low-level person and working in the Trump administration, and if you had enough of a juicy anti-Trump quote, you got promoted to being a senior administration official, and the press ran with it. Hmm. You know, in local news, there's an expression that says, if it bleeds, it leads. When it came to coverage of Trump, if it was anti-Trump, it got a bump. And that's not good journalism.
I was actually just going to ask you about if it bleeds, it leads, because I think among the public, that's always been a frustration, especially since 24-hour news started up, the advent of CNN and cable coverage. People have been exasperated by infotainment, basically. And, you know, I don't know that there's ever a way to go back to the old model. It's not really going anywhere. But in your sort of professional experience, and then sort of also looking at the Trump administration, how does the if it bleeds, it leads bias play into these other biases?
Well, the bias is in favor of selling things. They're right. A commercial product and they want to sell news. So the way you sell news nowadays is audiences are broken down by liberal and conservative. And so when Trump was president, they were out to get him. And that's what led me to write a book, because I want journalism to return to its days of neutrality. I want journalism to be trusted. I want to be able to wake up, read one source, and know I've read the news and I know what's factual. And then I'll give you my opinion about it. I'll tell you what should happen as a result. You don't need to tell me, but we don't have that right now. And I wish we did. So, you know, that's why I wrote, if it's anti-Trump, it gets a bump. That became the credo of the White House press corps. That became the credo of CBS, NBC, ABC, CNN, and the New York Times, et cetera. And it's a disservice to the public. I hear it all the time from people. Where can I go to get the news straight? And I think there's a yearning for that in this country.
If you're like me, you might be dreading looking at your 401k or IRA account balance lately. You're not alone, and we're hearing all of the experts say there's just no place to hide. But that's simply not true. The truth is you can build a financial bunker that grows and protects your money even during the scariest economic times. The Bank on Yourself retirement plan alternative lets you escape the financial carnage and has never had a losing year in over 160 years. Whether you've been investing for years or you're just starting out, now is the time to bypass Wall Street and bank on yourself. Bank on Yourself lets you reach your financial goals and dreams without taking any unnecessary risks. You get guaranteed predictable growth and retirement income with no luck, skill, or guesswork needed. The strategy also lets you take a tax-free retirement income, which protects you from the coming tax tsunami. Unlike a government-controlled 401k, IRA, or similar plan, you control the money in your plan, not the government. You can use the money for any purpose with no questions asked without interrupting the growth of your savings. This is the strategy famous businesses like McDonald's have used when no banker would lend them a dime, and almost anyone can do it. Plus, there's no volatility. Your plan doesn't go backward when the markets tumble. Both your principal and growth are protected. You can get a free report with all the details of how adding Bank on Yourself to your financial plan can help you take back control of your money. Just go to bankonyourself.com/Federalist. That's bankonyourself.com/Federalist. Yeah, the demand for that is frustrating, and there's this tug of war happening inside the legacy media right now, where you see once in a while you see people trying to push back in the newsrooms and from reporting. We know that at the New York Times, the Washington Post, for instance, some of the older reporters are very frustrated by, say, the Taylor Lorenzes of the world. There's a famous sort of spat between Maggie Haberman and Taylor Lorenz when Lorenz was over at the New York Times. What do you make of this? I imagine you still have a good number of contacts in media. Do any of them sort of privately tell you how bad it's gotten, or say this is a very real dichotomy, or this is a very real dynamic between older and younger? And do you see signs of a course correction inside the legacy media?
No, there is no course correction. Now, I'm fascinated to see what CNN is going to do with its new leadership, because yes, if you listen to them, they are saying they want to get back to neutrality in news. They have a long march to get there. But, you know, one vignette that I put in the book was one of my favorite reporters at the White House, unfailingly polite, a longtime correspondent, Bill Plant from CBS. He started there in 1964. He was still there when I was at the press secretary. And he retired only 6 years ago. And he was observing the animosity of the White House press corps toward Trump when Trump came in 2017. And he was on a TV show and he said, quote, "The important thing for reporters covering this is not to get involved personally in disputing this or disputing how we feel about the claim. I see tweets from people, no names, of course, who are offended by what's going on." Well, if you're offended by what's going on, you should keep it to yourself, Bill Plant said about his fellow White House reporters. The problem is reporters didn't want to keep it to themselves. They wanted to become famous like Jim Acosta. They wanted to tweet about it. They wanted to get book contracts. They wanted to get CNN, MSNBC contracts. So they started to let their opinions rip and oppose Donald Trump instead of being neutral right down the middle. And this is tearing certain newsrooms apart, because a younger generation of reporters who no longer believe in objectivity are taking over newsrooms. My chapter about the New York Times really goes through this with the Tom Cotton op-ed that said, "Send in the troops." It led to a meltdown at the New York Times, where New York Times newsroom reporter after reporter was saying that they feel their life is threatened by Tom Cotton's op-ed. That an op-ed, freedom of speech, a senator writing thoughts about what to do during all the riots and the looting and the arson in the summer of 2020, send in the troops, put them in danger? They're sitting at their house on a typewriter, on a laptop. They're saying they're in danger. That's the younger generation of reporters for you. And the older generation knows it's losing this battle for objectivity versus subjectivity. Subjectivity is taking over. And newsrooms are turning into college campuses, which is not a healthy place to be for free speech.
No, and people were sounding, the people on the right were sounding the warning signs about that transition for years, and the left ignored and laughed at it. And I think, you know, to their own detriment, and a lot of them are realizing the mess they created by that now. And your New York Times chapter is is really good. I mean, some of these things you kind of forget about. But when you're going back, you remember exactly how insane a lot of this was. And it's a good example of this very specific question I want to ask you about Twitter, because all of those New York Times staffers tweeted in unison, which included actually Taylor Lorenz at the time, this op-ed puts Black New York Times staffers in danger. That's a paraphrase of it. It's probably pretty close to what they actually tweeted in unison. And that's a very obvious airing of an opinion. But when you're framing these issues as, I was talking about this with Howie Kurtz on Media Buzz this week, if you're framing a question as a human rights issue, or, you know, then you're putting the person on the other side of it as an enemy of human rights. And if you're putting, you know, somebody who wants to make this historical case about the National Guard quelling riots as somebody who's putting the lives of Black New York Times staffers in danger, this is a really unhealthy place to be. And we got to see it play out on Twitter. I'm curious as to how you think Twitter very specifically has affected this problem in the media.
Yeah. And the irony here, of course, the only thing that was putting reporters or anybody's lives in danger were the rioters, the looters, and the arsonists.
Right.
And they call out the senator who said, send in the troops, which most Democrat governors did, by the way, send in troops to quell those riots. But these young New York Times reporters only argued with Tom Cotton, not with the Democrat governors who actually sent in the troops. Twitter has made everything worse. You can't stop it. I love technology. I like Twitter myself. But Twitter has given voice to the woke passions of the young left. And it's made the older generation of news reporters quiver because they don't want to take them on. They're scared to death. And you see it particularly on any issue involves so-called, quote unquote, social justice. Once somebody says, I'm crying social justice, you almost have no recourse. You have to surrender. And that's what happened to the editors at the New York Times. This is why they killed the Tom Cotton op-ed. It appeared online. It did not appear in the print paper because of the rebellion inside the newsroom. And when there is one of these rebellions, there's almost nothing older, more established journalists can do to stop it, because they'll be seen as racist. They'll be seen as homophobic. They'll be seen as xenophobic. Whatever word you want to attach to it, the young woke left is taking over. And Twitter is the vehicle that is carrying their words, their message, their passion. But it's also why the American people are so solidly turning against the left. It's why the Hispanic vote is increasingly becoming conservative. The woke left is nuts. And to the degree that older, more old-tuned liberals are yielding to the woke left, they're making the Democrat Party a shell of what it used to be, and it can no longer be a majority party. They're killing themselves. You know, one of the things I wrote in the book is that the press is not the enemy of the people, but they're their own worst enemy. And Twitter is one reason why.
I remember back in, when I was in high school, so it wasn't... I'm not that old, so it wasn't terribly old, terribly long ago, but it was during the Bush administration. Looking at one of the things that
you're saying I'm old.
No, I'm saying you're wise and experienced, Ari. One of the things that I remember, it's actually one of the things that made me want to move to D.C., watching Hollywood and the media trash people who, you know, went to church every week, owned firearms, believed, you know, life begins at conception, any of these things, or believed in traditional marriage, whatever it was, just get absolutely trashed as rubes and, you know, stupid. You could go back to all of this stuff from the Bush era. And it seems to me this was really this theory, the book that really helped me see it was Coming Apart. And I wonder, you know, if you look back on that era too now and see how this was emerging just in the way Hollywood and the media, the news media talked about average Americans.
Oh, absolutely. It's what led rise to Donald Trump. Donald Trump would not have been elected if the left and the media was not as snooty as they were, if they didn't look down their noses at people, and everybody knows it, there wouldn't have been this recognition that it's time for an outsider. It's time for somebody who's going to give as good as they get. And if Donald Trump went too far, it was fine with a lot of people because they knew that the left had gone too far themselves. And there is no question that that, and it was really during the Obama years, helped coarsen the culture and created the environment for Donald Trump to come roaring in to fight back. So I definitely agree with what you said.
Yeah. And then the devil's advocate would, well, let me ask you about the Charles Murray point, because the coming apart point, because that's another interesting thing that my opinion on that has changed. My opinion on things like WTO and NAFTA have changed over time, looking at the way that they contributed to this isolation or this social sorting. Because Murray talks about how educated elites are increasingly wildly disproportionately represented in super zips and pockets of the country that wield disproportionate control over our politics and our culture. Do you think that there was maybe naivete on the right, maybe the Bush administration in the early 2000s, about how some of these policies and these ideas would play out in the culture?
Well, a couple of things. First, I'm really glad you're talking about Charles Murray. I love that book. And as a Middlebury graduate, I'm embarrassed by the way my college treated Charles Murray when he went to speak there. But yeah, this is another sign of how things changed. You know, and I remember being at the Ways and Means Committee in the 90s, even before the Bush White House. And all my bosses on Ways and Means were for international trade agreements, for NAFTA, for all the agreements. And I guess I was too, because I was a free trader. That was the ideology I was raised in. I thought that makes sense, creates jobs. But as I watched the coverage, I remembered thinking to myself in the 90s, where's the point of view of the blue-collar worker? Where's the point of view of the factory worker who, you know, we're told is going to lose their job? It creates some jobs, but they're going to lose their job. They're going to go to Mexico or they're going to go to China. But I guess we're told that's good because it's more efficient for society.
Hmm.
And I just remember thinking, my bosses are getting good press, so I've got nothing to complain about. The press agrees with us. Free trade is what it should be. But I remember clearly thinking, who's talking about blue collar needs? And it was a dearth. It was an absence. Flash forward to the Bush years, engagement with China was perceived as essential to bring China into the world fold. The thinking was that if we bring China into the WTO, the World Trade Organization, it'll make China more like us. What we missed and what Donald Trump saw was bringing China into the World Trade Organization means China's going to try to make us, or whoever they can pick off, Belgium, Holland, France, Germany, more like them. And that is what was missed. Donald Trump saw it. And he blew the whistle on it. It's another reason why times change and events are dynamic.
Hmm. And I'm sure one question that you've gotten a lot over the years and probably thought about is the, and you were out of the Bush White House, I think you left in 2003, right, Ari?
Correct.
So the lead up, of course, to the Iraq War and to Afghanistan and all of this, do you feel like any of that contributed, or the Bush administration's communication strategy or communications mistakes? Do you think any of that contributed to the sense of institutional distrust that average Americans have in media still today?
I don't think it contributes to the distrust in the media. I think it contributes to the distrust in government, distrust in intelligence agencies and their conclusions. I guess by extension, you could say that extended to media. I did not fault the media for their stories about Saddam having weapons of mass destruction. We all thought he did.
Mm-hmm.
That was the straightforward conclusion of the CIA going back to the Clinton years, consistent with the Bush years. It was what everybody thought. Not only in the United States, but French intelligence, Egyptian intelligence, Israeli intelligence. Tragically, we were all wrong. So I don't blame the media for that. But I do think when you look again, Donald Trump coming along, and I think Trump changed his tune. He was for the Iraq War, and then he was against it. But he, in his campaign, bashed these missions abroad. And it did contribute to a hollowing out of the Republican Party's more aggressive foreign policy wing, where many people became neutral or anti-interventionist. That was a dramatic change from the early 2000s.
So I definitely consider my incessant skepticism both a blessing and a curse. It's a blessing in journalism for sure. But as I've watched all of these MyPillow ads over the years, I have just been plagued by the question, are these as good as the commercials say they are? I've always wondered this. And when the fine folks over at MyPillow were kind enough to send me some of their products, I was really pleasantly surprised. These things are great. And right now they're having a BOGO extravaganza. So you can get buy one, get one free pricing on the MyPillow bed sheets as low as $59.98, the Elegance MyPillows as low as $49.98, and that six-piece towel sets. Those are my favorite. Those are included in the BOGO extravaganza. Also, the Roll and Go Anywhere My Pillows for $29.98 and so much more. Those six-piece towel sets are made with cotton grown here in the United States. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch. I can confirm that. It's absolutely true. Like I said, these are my favorites. They have no lotiony feel either. Every set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and two washcloths. So you got everything you need. They're available in a variety of colors and sizes, and they are machine washable and come with a 60-day money-back guarantee and a one-year limited warranty. Those Roll and Go Anywhere MyPillows, you can use them on your couch, your recliner, or in your car. They're versatile enough to take on vacation or really anywhere you go. They're also available in multiple colors and patterns and machine washable and dryable for all you parents. That's the most important part. They come with a 10-year warranty and a 60-day money-back guarantee as well. So as you can see, it's a buy one, get one extravaganza over at mypillow.com/Federalist. Bedsheets and MyPillows are just the tip of the iceberg. Find the full list of BOGO offers by visiting mypillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. Stock up with buy one, get one free savings today and get Mike's book free with any purchase. MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. MyPillow.com/Federalist. It's such a super important point. I remember a couple of months ago, we had someone from the Quincy Institute on the podcast who was talking about how the failures ultimately with the intelligence community back then were just immense, and everything trickles from their failures. It's a very well taken point. And Ari, I want to ask also, just putting my sort of like, you know, Wisconsin hat back on, somebody who grew up, you know, outside of Milwaukee, a lot of what I thought until I got to DC was that so much of this was orchestrated, that the media was doing a lot of this intentionally. And I think that's kind of changed. I do think more of it is intentional now. But how would you explain why the media gets so much wrong? The balance between how much of it is just outright lying, the balance of how much of it is just mistakes because they have these blinders on, they live in echo chambers. How would you explain that to somebody who's outside DC, hasn't had a lot of interaction with national media? What's really going on here?
And I explained that in my first chapter. It's called Original Sin. And my point is that reporters have a diversity problem. They're too cut from the same cloth. They are just too much college-educated Democratic voters. And they don't really come from backgrounds where they are religious. They went to church or synagogue on a regular basis, that they own a gun growing up, that their father and their grandfather own guns, that life begins at conception, that it's actually a respectable point of view to say that abortion might be murder. They just can't relate to that. Journalism today consists of so many people who think if only those other people had read the New York Times and CNN, they never would have supported Donald Trump. If only they were exposed to the truth and the facts. And that's the problem with journalism. They're all Democrats. They're overwhelmingly Democrats. You know, one of my favorite things I did in the book, it's going to make reporters' heads explode, is I hired a research company to just look up the public records of the White House press corps to study who's a Democrat and who's a Republican. And while many of them are independent, which I find to be window dressing, I don't think they really are independent, 12-1 is the ratio of Democrats to Republicans as registered voters in the White House press corps on the 49 seats the first day the briefing room was filled post-COVID. 49 seats, 49 reporters, 12-1 ratio, Democrat to Republican. Imagine, Emily, if it was 12-1 Republican to Democrat. If newsrooms consisted 12-1 of Republicans over Democrat, I guarantee you stories about life would be different. Stories about the invisible hand of Adam Smith, capitalism, would be entirely different. We'd be reading so many stories about people who were lifted up from poverty and brought into the middle class, or people from the middle class who became wealthy thanks to hard work and that invisible hand that I just cited. But you don't see that. What you see are stories about the left wing's agenda, because reporters are cut from the same liberal cloth, and it's self-selection of who goes into journalism. And the only way to fix that is J schools, journalism schools, newsrooms everywhere need to aggressively start to hire people who are different, who think differently, come from different regions of the country, who have different experiences, different ideologies. You know, they care so much about race. They care so much about gender. They say care so much about sexual orientation, but they do not care about diversity when it's measured by what matters most, which is what do you think? And that's why they make so many mistakes, because there's hardly anybody in the newsroom to say, before you put that anti-Trump thing on the air, CNN, shouldn't we check it? CNN led the league in a number of retracted stories about how wrong about Donald Trump, almost all about collusion. It's because they wanted the stories to be true. A diverse newsroom ideologically would have protected CNN so they didn't make those mistakes.
That is so true. And I wonder also if the late great Andrew Breitbart had this idea that I think a lot of people on the right probably share. I'm kind of torn on it myself, but the idea that if reporters were just honest about their biases. Like, Twitter was great from this perspective because it encouraged all of these reporters to, you know, they couldn't help it. They have like this reflex where they have to share their opinions on certain issues. And so it helped readers see where reporters are and really tore back the curtain. And it's actually similar to what Wes Lowery, the famous liberal columnist, has said, is that it's time to sort of drop the pretense and stop doing what they call derisively both sidesism. I think I disagree with that. I think there are some people who should be capable of being neutral and presenting both sides. And it's absolutely essential, of course, whether you're on the left or the right, to have both sides included in your perspective. Otherwise, you're going to miss something ultimately. Ari, what do you think about that dynamic? Do you think reporters should just, is one way to fix the media for reporters to just drop the pretense and be honest about what their opinions are? Or is it to really continue pursuing neutrality and equality in coverage?
Well, this is exactly what a lot of young reporters are saying. They're saying there is no objectivity. Everybody has their own biases, their own subjectivity. And so we bring our subjectivity, our lived experiences to our coverage. Mm-hmm. Well, that's BS. There is objectivity. The advantage reporters have is that there's a lot of them, and there are places where I'm not, you're not, citizens not, because we're working. We're doing our jobs. Reporters should be working to observe the news and just tell us what took place. Mm-hmm. Tell us he said, she said. One side pointed this out, the other side pointed that out. But reporters misinterpret that and think context is what they have to provide readers, which means analysis, which now means opinions, which now means tweets. And they're all coming from the left, overwhelmingly coming from the left. And that's what's killing journalism. So, you know, one of the themes of my book is journalism has got to return to those old days of objectivity, of the he said, she said, and neutrality. That's the only way they'll regain trust. Otherwise, we all just stay in our niches and the right hears from the right. Listen and talk to only people on the right. The left does the same thing, and the country further divides.
Mm. And I'm also curious if you were advising. There's a really one thing that I saw as objectively very positive is when the RNC took a step back from the Presidential Debates Commission and said, you have not met reasonable requests for ensuring fairness in the debates coming up in the upcoming primary, basically. And so we won't be participating. We're going to find other sources to host these debates outside of the commission. And there's a debate in the Republican Party itself about how much politicians, candidates should be seeking coverage from legacy media, and whether they should be talking, you know, to the New York Times, the Washington Post, whatever it is. Do you have a take on that? Do you have an idea on somebody who's been a media strategist, is a media strategist? What is the right way for Republicans to handle this question of whether or not they cooperate with legacy media that treats them like garbage and in many cases, you know, will basically frame something they said as malicious or whatever when it clearly was not? Should Republicans still be working with these outlets?
Well, first, hallelujah for the RNC. That was a smart decision. They're not getting a fair shake, so they shouldn't have those debates sponsored by those same people. But I do believe Republicans should talk to those outlets, if only because it makes you sharper. There's nothing wrong playing a little devil's advocate, sharpening up your ideas. You know, I knew when I briefed the press that I had an away game every time. You know, Joe Biden's press secretary knows they have a home game every time. I have to work harder and think smarter. than any of the Biden staff, because only Fox News asks hard questions to the White House press secretary. And I do think you want to have a broader appeal than just your base. There remain, it's shrunk dramatically, a number of independent voters. But just from an intellectual point of view, I like taking my case to other people to make it. Now, if you're a politician, you want to get reelected, you've got to rev up your own base, your own supporters. So I understand why it might be different for real life politics and an intellectual exercise. But I still think at the end of the day, you're made stronger if you can take your case comfortably and confidently to somebody who disagrees with you.
No, absolutely. I think that's a very good point. One thing that bothered me in the Trump administration, and not from the perspective of a reporter or journalist, but just simply from a strategy perspective, is how often they would clearly give news or scoops to the legacy media. And my perspective was always, you know, you could starve them of that and feed new media, and maybe it would help restore a balance and sort of pressure them to do better. But maybe that's just my harebrained theory.
100%, Emily. I totally agree with that. That's a reflection of the division that we have right now. So there's a lot to what you said. Part of the problem, though, and I get into this in the book, is suppression. So when Rudy Giuliani gave the New York Post the story about how Joe Biden had been lying about not having talked to his son Hunter on business deals, as proven in the laptop, because the story broke in the New York Post, right-wing New York Post, the media looked down on its nose at the story. They didn't say, could this be true? Should we be chasing this? Did we get beat? And then social media giants suppressed the story. I often thought if that story had broken in the New York Times or the Washington Post, every reporter would have run with it, and Joe Biden would have been in big trouble. Nevertheless, the New York Times, Washington Post may never have printed it to begin with. So it's a really interesting question you ask.
That is a fascinating thought experiment, actually. Going back to it, I wonder what the how differently the consequence would have been of that story. Ari Fleischer, this is so interesting, such a fun and fascinating conversation, like the book itself, which, again, as I said, there's so many. The media got so much wrong during the Trump era, and in some, I guess, humorous ways. You forget all of their blunders, and the book does such a good job of capturing that scope. Thank you for joining us on Federalist Radio Hour, Ari.
Thank you, Emily. It's wonderful to be with you.
The book is called Suppression, Deception, Snobbery, and Bias: Why the Press Gets So Much Wrong and Just Doesn't Care. It's by Ari Fleischer, out on July 12th. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.